Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in the show, the Ag Secretary talks about the future direction for U.S. agriculture. But we start off today with a look at the current cost of doing business in the citrus industry.
My Ag Life in Citrus is brought to you by Soil and Crop Incorporated, your number one resource for sustainable crop nutrition by putting nature to work for you.
Joining me today is Casey Creamer, President and CEO of California Citrus Mutual.
California Citrus Mutual recently put out a news release highlighting the cost of production for citrus growers. Casey, can we start off with you giving me just an overview of that, please?
Yeah, it started, we did a naval orange cost survey just before the pandemic, really trying to communicate out to the membership to how have costs changed over the last several years with, you know, labor costs going up, rules and regulations, water costs. So there's lots of, the costs just keep rising for citrus growers. And so we really want to get a good industry average of how things have changed. And so we did that, but then, you know, the pandemic, it just really changed everything. There's been a limited supply of lots of things, transportation issues, containers at the port. You're starting to see fuel prices go really high. And so we just felt like, all the what we had heard from our membership is that these costs are skyrocketing. And so we really wanted to look at it and say, how have they changed since the start of the pandemic? Because we thought they were going to be drastic, but we really wanted to verify that as an industry. And so we took a look at that. We knew what some of the major cost drivers were and try to put something together that was a good industry average. And so we did that.
You mentioned several of the things that are causing price increases, but let's focus in on a couple. And two that are mentioned specifically in the news release that I saw were water and shipping. Tell me about how these two things are affecting the industry.
Yeah, so the shipping costs themselves have just absolutely catapulted. I think we put a number of $12,000 a container. For some, that may be low. It's probably a decent average, but we also know that number is going even higher. And so the cost that we calculated are roughly 380% increase from since prior to the pandemic of what it cost to get a container and do export. But the impacts are much greater than just the costs of the containers, because the backups at the ports have created a logjam and prevented shipments from going out. And so that loss of sales has been tremendously impactful to California citrus growers, not just in the export market, but also in the domestic market, because of trying to move additional product on the domestic market, frankly, at lower prices than what we could get export. So a significant impact to the industry.
And citrus is not one of those crops that can sit around at the ports for a while or take some time with shipping. That needs to be handled very efficiently for citrus.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say we are a perishable commodity. We can probably withstand, you know, some delays at the ports, because we can hold for a little while. Not like some of the other much more perishable commodities, but it's very important to get it as quickly as possible. I mean, we're going from harvest to through the packing house and on a truck within a day or maybe two at the most. And so it's very important that we have fresh product. And when we're shipping overseas, you know, a lot of places that we send it, it takes 3 weeks to get there, 2.5 to 3.5 weeks to get there. And so the goal is to have the freshest piece of fruit for the consumer so they come back for more. And the delays at the ports, if it's 1 day, 2 days, we were seeing weeks, it affects that end quality. And it's utmost importance that we keep, you know, high quality products in the market.
And then let's talk about water. Now, our agricultural listeners will know this, of course, but we also get a lot of consumer listeners, and it's nice to explain some different things to them as well. When we talk about California and agriculture, drought always comes up. Of course, we are in a drought year. Water is hard this year, but water is also expensive. So how has the cost of water been impacting the citrus industry?
Yeah, so There's water is a difficult thing to quantify. You've got regions, you've got north, south, east, and west, you've got surface water rights and no surface water rights, whether you have delivery of surface water even available to you. And so, you know, we try to just look at the spot market for water and take some estimates where something might have cost $300 an acre foot to get by excess water prior to the drought is now ranging from $1,000 to $2,000. And that's even if you can get it at that. I mean, people are willing to bid, you know, $2,000 plus for water, which is completely unsustainable. You will not make a profit if you're paying that much for your surface water per acre foot. And so it's significant. You know, that spot market is big. I mean, we're also seeing cost increases, pumping cost increases. The groundwater table is not, you know, what it used to be. We get lots of reports from growers of wells with diminished capacity, having to drill deeper wells. And then the cost of drilling those wells and the repairs that are skyrocketing as well because of the demand that's out there. So there are significant costs across the board, and water is a major driver, and probably a major driver of what the cultural costs that we're estimating to be up on average 19% across the board.
And then to put a dollar amount on it, when we talk about 19%, the dollar amount I saw was an average of, I believe it was $1,000 per acre, just in an increase of business expenses. Is that right?
Yeah, it just our industry average is probably a little bit under 1,000, but 1,000 is kind of like that number. If it was 984 or something like that, but on average, I definitely there's people that the cost impacts, especially on water, with, you know, if they're in a dire situation, are going to be much higher than that. But on average for the industry, probably somewhere right around $1,000 an acre. And that's nothing to sneeze at. That's significant. And that's just an increase. So,
yeah. And that is significant. And there's a lot of romanticism around farming where we're talking about growing food for people and nourishing people. But bottom line, every farm is also a business, and business decisions have to be made. And the businesses have to keep running if we're going to continue providing, you know, food and nutritious citrus and things to people. When we're talking about these business decisions now, as in any industry, when your costs increase so substantially, it is hard to keep these businesses surviving. What can farmers do to keep their businesses going so that we can continue to have California grown fresh fruits and vegetables? What can be done?
Yeah, the number one thing that I would say to a grower dealing with this situation right now is they have to understand their own costs and how they are changing, because this is an industry average that we're talking about, and really the rate of change, I'm pretty certain probably the rate of change is probably pretty consistent, but everybody sort of sits in a different place, whether you have water rights, what you're particularly you're growing, but everybody needs to really take a hard look at their costs and have a conversation with their packing houses and marketers. Are the varieties that I'm growing, the varieties that I'm planting, gonna get the return that's necessary to stay in business? And so that's the first thing. We need to have people who are on top of that. And for a large part, I think the industry is, but I think that the rate of change is happening, and it's just a refocus and just make sure that they can. And then second, we've got to work together to change the direction, the policies that are affecting these changes. And look, I'd love to be able to give all of our growers answers on the water situation yesterday. I want to give them answers on the labor situation costs yesterday. But the reality is that we didn't get here overnight on all of these issues. These were, you know, just add-ons, continual issues. And we need to have a unified, cohesive effort, strong effort to peel these things back, to make things better than what they would have been to protect the future of the industry as well. And so, it's real easy to with the frustration that's out there right now, to look at things and give up. And I don't know any other way but to keep on fighting and keep on working. And so I just, stay on top of things, stay informed, communicate with us, communicate with other growers, and let's stick together and do everything we can to better the situation now and for tomorrow.
Then my last question would be for you, how do you see this trickling down to the consumer? Do you think consumers will see a difference in prices?
I think it has to. California grows 90% of the fresh citrus available in the United States, and that has to be passed on to consumers, unfortunately. And so a lot of times policymakers will kind of, it's okay to pass it on to the grower, but when things start to get to the voter, it's a little different story. But voters and consumers are going to pay more for California citrus. And this directly impacts us, but it directly impacts every consumer here in the United States. And so we just need to take a careful look at all of our policies so that we can, keep growers profitable and keep food affordable.
You can find that news release with those figures on the California Citrus Mutual website. Our news brief is up next. We will be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlanté is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlanté wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplanté.com.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Here's your news for today. A hearing on milk pricing recently took place in the Senate regarding Class 1 milk mover. Alan Biorga, the Senior Vice President of Communications with the National Milk Producers Federation, says the hearing took place because U.S. dairy farmers are frustrated with the federal milk marketing order system.
Yeah, this really all plays together. And of course, you start unraveling issues like the federal milk marketing order system, and you quickly become bewildered by the complexity. But we at National Milk have really been focusing on the Class 1 movers an issue because, as you know, it's really at the root of a lot of what was going on last year. And this was really more sort of an educational, informational hearing to get some of the concerns that dairy farmers have out into the public eye. There's a lot of discussion about some of these issues in terms of milk pricing, really some of the stresses that we've seen through the pandemic, some of the weaknesses and flaws that have really been highlighted by what's been going on over the past year.
Witnesses at the hearing talked about the current problems with the milk mover.
We have a couple things going on revolving around the Class 1 mover. You have this pandemic market volatility assistance program that the USDA just announced last month that is supposed to at least partially compensate farmers for some of the losses that they experience because of the change of the mover formula into the 2018 Farm Bill. Then the other question was really looking at what do you do with the Class 1 mover itself? You still have this problem here.
U.S. dairy farmers lost a lot of money after the mover was changed in the 2018 Farm Bill.
Your first problem is that farmers lost about $750 million because of this change, and the USDA's program compensates $350. So where does that other $400 million go, and how do you come up with some sort of a solution that's fair to all sizes and regions? It's going to be a really challenging thing when these checks come out, because I guarantee you no two dairy farmers are going to get the same amount of money in a check. And how this formula is determined is not going to seem very transparent to a lot of these producers.
Bjorge says some of the risk that shifted from processors to producers needs to be evened out.
Meanwhile, you're heading into the next Farm Bill and you're looking at, okay, what do we do to make sure that this problem doesn't happen again? Dairy farmers right now, the way the mover is structured, as we have seen from the pandemic, compared with processors, a lot of price risk now falls on the back of the farmer that wasn't falling back there before. So how do we make sure that this is an equitable risk? What sort of a formula do you come up with? There are several proposals out there, and NMPF has its own. There are some other ones floating around as well. We've got to figure out for Congress, what is the best solution? Because this is a problem that needs to be solved.
Meanwhile, there were some notable changes reflected in the Ag Department's September outlook of dairy production, supply and demand, and prices. Rod Bain reports.
The latest look at the U.S. dairy balance sheet indicates
we're forecasting lower production this month for both 2021 and 2022 based on what we're observing as lower cow numbers as well as reduced milk per cow. And we expect those lower cow numbers and lower growth in milk per cow to carry into 2022 as well.
Yet USDA World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekodowski notes production for both years would be up. Lower commercial use both years is offset by increased exports, while imports are expected to rise slightly. From the prices perspective,
we raised most of our prices almost across the board for both 2021 and 2022, just reflecting the fact that we're seeing relatively strong dairy product demand of late, combined with those higher milk supplies that we're both seeing and forecasting into 2022.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Opportunities to promote pork and educate the public are growing in California with the appointment of a full-time executive director for the California Pork Producers Association. Jill Damski previously served several commodities with Ag Association Management Services. Thanks to a pork checkoff grant, she's now able to focus on pork education and promotion in this important market, which consumes a lot of pork.
Over 15% of the country's market is consumed in California. California obviously is often on the leading edge of decision making and things that can affect the whole country. This new role is kind of a joint effort and partnership between California and supported with National Pork Board checkoff dollars.
California's diverse production and protein sectors show a lot of support for the pork industry. In her role, Damski will serve California's pork producers by promoting pork as a nutritious and sustainable protein source that was raised with ethical principles top of mind.
California is so diverse, but also a place where there's over 400 different crops grown here. So it's very common for a producer, whether that's a crop or a protein producer, to really be involved in more than one industry or association, which I think creates a lot of positive crossover. It creates a really strong farm and ag movement.
California represents about 15% of the pork industry's market, with a population of nearly 40 million people. That includes significant Asian and Hispanic demographics that are more likely to eat pork. She says pork is a national product, and her role is a great opportunity to share what is happening in California to other state representatives.
I think it's also really important to bring to the national level and to all the other state executives what is happening in California and how very different it is. What that could mean for other states as well, states that ship pork to us for any type of market. It really is a national product.
That's our news for today. We will be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack spoke Monday at an Ag Outlook Forum in Kansas City, Missouri. It was hosted by the Agriculture Business Council of Kansas City and AgriPulse. Secretary Vilsack talked about the future of agriculture. Here are his comments.
As Sarah indicated, I just returned from Florence, Italy, a three-day event where the agricultural ministers and representatives from the G20 appeared and conferred for a number of days. It was important for the United States to be there in Italy to have this conversation simply because there are now a number of key events that will occur in the next couple of weeks that I think have a direct bearing on the direction of agriculture globally into the future. We, as you may know, we have a UN Food System Summit coming up next week, and following that, shortly after that, is COP26, which will be in Scotland, where the world will come together to talk about climate and the impact and effect that climate is having on agriculture and steps that will be taken in order to address the impact, both in terms of adaptation and mitigation, and also in terms of how things need to be structured to reduce emissions connected to agriculture so that we're in the process of responding to what is a growing desire on the part of the marketplace for ultimately a net zero emission agriculture. So it was important for me to be there in Florence because our European friends, as you know, have a new common agricultural policy, which they commonly refer to as Farm to Fork, and their member countries are now in the process of implementing that new common agricultural policy. It's a policy that is really focused on transitioning significantly and transforming the way in which they provide subsidies and help to farmers across the EU in exchange for environmental good practices. We wanted to make sure that the world understood that there was a consensus on the ultimate goal, which is to in fact get to a net zero emission agriculture by the year 2050, simply because the market demands it. But understanding that there were multiple and different ways to obtain that goal. The EU has chosen one way. We in the United States believe that a market-oriented, incentive-based, voluntary system is effective and will be effective to get us to the same destination. So it was important and necessary for us to voice that alternative. And then to seek, as I did in bilateral discussions with a number of agricultural ministers, the beginnings of a coalition of nations that feel as we do, that voluntary, market-based, science-driven approaches to climate will result ultimately in us reaching the goal of net zero emissions. I had a very good, solid conversation with my counterpart in Brazil, for example, where I think both of us understand and appreciate that we can't let our European friends basically dominate this conversation and basically suggest that there's a single way to get to this ultimate goal. We also wanted to make sure that people understood and appreciated that this, whatever system we utilize in ultimately getting to this goal, should not be used as a barrier to trade. We wanted to make sure that the message about the openness and the transparency of trade relationships need to continue. And so that goal, I think, was achieved. I think we are in the process of beginning to develop coalitions. We also look forward to adding to a number of nations that have already committed to the Agriculture Innovation Mission for Climate, AIM for C, which is going to be sort of launched at the UN Food Summit system in terms of encouraging people to join, countries to join this coalition, and then ultimately formally announced, if you will, at the COP26. The United States and the United Arab Emirates are leading this effort to secure a number of countries to participate in this coalition, and I think we already have somewhere between 10 and 15 countries that have already made a commitment to be part of this effort. And that too was a goal of mine in discussions with representatives from Spain and Italy, and again, Brazil, as well as individual conversations I had with other ministers, encouraging them to participate. The Japanese minister, for example, was also a seatmate at one of our lunch meetings, and I had the opportunity to make and extend the invitation to him as well. So it's a real, I think, an important forum for us to have leadership position, and I think it was appreciated that I made the effort to get to Italy. On the issue of exports, as you know, we are projecting for fiscal year 21, that ends this month, a record export year, significantly higher than the previous export year that was set in, record year that was set in 2014. We expect and anticipate and project potentially the record set this year will also be surpassed next year. Key, obviously, to exports in terms of agriculture is our continued relationship with China. And I think it's fair to say that while we recognize that China has indeed increased its commitments and increased its purchases over the last several years as a result of a phase one agreement, that they have not yet actually met the requirements of phase one. And I think it's expected and anticipated that we'll continue to press China for meeting their promised levels of sales and transactions. You know, this is an incredibly complex relationship. And I think it's sometimes easy for those who are in a particular industry, whether it's agriculture or any other industry, to look at this in a very microscopic way, focusing simply on our particular interests or our particular industry. But the reality is the relationship with China has multiple layers and multiple levels. It has a national security level. It has a climate security level. It has a trade level. It has an economic competition level. It has a global leadership level where we are articulating the belief that a democratic approach to governance in the 21st century is a more effective and more efficient way of governing people that establishes and protects a certain level of liberty and freedom. The Chinese government making the case that an authoritative government approach in this 21st century day, a year and time of change is a more appropriate role for governments to assume. So we're involved in a multiple level complex relationship with China, and every piece of that relationship impacts and affects every other piece of that relationship. And it's not a simple thing to put together how to approach China as you consider the approach to China in trade, as you consider the approach to China on climate change, as you consider the approach to China on the security of nations in the South China Sea, the freedoms and liberties of those who live in Hong Kong, or minorities who reside in China. So it's important for us to continue to press China on phase one. It's important for us to understand as well the complexity of this relationship. We continue to reach out to a number of agricultural ministers on the export side. I'll again have another conversation with Secretary Villalobos here in the near future. I expect to participate with him and the Canadian minister pending the elections at the World Food Prize, where we can have a conversation, continue conversation about the implementation of USMCA. Looking forward to Mexico finalizing once and for all its access to potatoes for U.S. potato access into their market. It's been a 14 to 15 year struggle to get that done. We continue to press them on issues relating to GE corn, and some of the other issues that have cropped up in this relationship. We also continue, obviously, to have conversations with our Canadian friends. Again, elections have a tendency to make those conversations a bit more complex, but our trade representative, Ambassador Tai, has proceeded with the consultation that is a prerequisite to additional steps under the USMCA for enforcement, and we are certainly supportive of that effort on the dairy side. Good news coming out of Vietnam, a number of tariffs have been reduced, a number of SBS barriers to our products have been reduced, which allows us to encourage more trade with that important country. And recently, the EU did require and allow us to have a bit more time in order to satisfy their health certificate for livestock. We were deeply concerned that that might impact and affect about $1.5 billion of livestock sales in the EU. We continue to work with them to make sure that that health certificate is something that is doable and practical in terms of our relationship and our trade relationship. I know that everyone's interested in the undersecretary position, nobody more so than I am. We have several candidates that we're in the process, the final process of looking at, and both of the candidates that I know we are looking at are people that are well familiar with trade, and I think people that will be able to get the kind of support necessary to get through the confirmation process. And I realize that my senator, Senator Grassley, has encouraged us to do this. I would also sort of push back on the senator a little bit and encourage him to help us get the holds that are on a number of Biden-Harris conferees lifted in the Senate so that we can get a full complement of people at work at USDA and other departments throughout the government. We've only had one undersecretary up to this point confirmed. We've got a number of them pending in the Senate, and we have a number in the Senate Ag Committee that are awaiting a vote. Hopefully that process speeds up. Let me talk briefly about drought assistance. It's something that we are deeply concerned about. Since nearly all of Western U.S. is impacted and affected, 95% of the Western states now have drought conditions that are D2, D3, or D4. We're looking for creative ways to expand significantly the help and assistance. Most recently, we announced a permanent change, to our Emergency Livestock Honeybee and Farm Fish Assistance Program, ELAP. We now are making it available not only to provide assistance and help to reduce the cost of water hauling, but we also understand and appreciate that a number of producers across the country will be spending a significant amount of money to be able to transport feed more than 25 miles from home, less than 1,000 miles from their operation. We're now going to try to provide assistance in the form of roughly 60% of the reimbursement of the cost of that feed. For some producers, it could be as high as 90% reimbursement. We're going to start with an average of about $6.60 per mile, and then we're going to just basically take a look and see how we might be able to provide additional adjustments based on regional differences that may exist. This is for livestock producers that are raising livestock for hay and grazing. We're looking at other ways in which we could potentially use some of the tools we have at USDA to provide additional help and assistance for other livestock producers. We, as you know, recently announced a fairly significant amount of assistance and help for our dairy producers, a little over almost $1.2 billion. In assistance and help, which has been part of about $11 billion of announcements and disbursements that we've made under the pandemic assistance and Build Back Better efforts at USDA. Most recently, focused on contract growers who didn't receive adequate compensation under the previous COVID programs, as well as looking at the processing industry. Some of the ag workers who had to incur expense during the onset of COVID, as I said, our dairy operators. Just a couple more comments, and then I'll turn it over to the questions, if that's appropriate. I know there's a lot of interest in the biofuel industry, and obviously all of us are waiting for the EPA to finalize and to decide the RFS limits. But in the meantime, we have been working with the Department of Energy, the EPA and others to begin the process of developing a new industry, if you will, which is in the aviation fuel. We recently announced the Grand Challenge of Aviation Fuel Challenge, designed initially to generate 3 billion gallons of bio-based 100% drop-in aviation fuel by the year 2030, which will help reduce airline emissions, particularly for long international flights, by roughly 20%. As you may know, the air industry represents about 11% of our transportation emissions, and I think it's likely that we're going to continue to see a real push to ultimately develop an aviation fuel that meets a bio-based aviation fuel that meets the entire need for the aviation industry, which is about a 35 billion gallon industry opportunity by the year 2050. The USDA is engaged in a number of projects focused on feedstock analysis and feedstock development. The Department of Energy has announced a series of additional resources for projects, which could ultimately amount to a little over $4 billion of assistance and help. The Build Back Better Reconciliation Bill currently contains a fairly significant tax credit that will also help to fuel, no pun intended, this industry. So it's a complement to the the light transportation assistance that we currently have under the RFS with cars and trucks, and confident that we're going to continue to need a significant amount of biofuel in the future, particularly as we increase mileage standards. It's going to require higher octane. You get that higher octane through biofuels.
We have more from the forum right after this.
Agrimiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agrimiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agrimiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Continuing our coverage of the Ag Outlook Forum, U.S. Senator Jerry Moran of Kansas gave opening comments and talked about where agriculture is headed.
I was, as Sarah indicated, I put 5,500 miles on my truck during this August recess. It was one of the few times in which I asked the leadership of the Senate to call us back into session with my anger and concern about what was transpiring in our departure in Afghanistan. I thought the United States Senate should be at work with officials under oath and testimony and hearings and the ability to convey on behalf of Kansans and my own views as to what should be taking place in Afghanistan. I would ask that you, in Republican majority days, I chair the Committee on Veterans Affairs in the Senate. I'm now the longest serving, I think, Republican in the history of serving on veterans committees, both in the House and Senate. And I would just highlight and ask a favor of you for the good of the country and for the good of those who served our nation. The number of calls to the veteran suicide hotline is up double digits. The texts and emails are the same. And the concern is that there are those who are seeing what's transpiring in Afghanistan and feeling that their service was not of value. And if you all could, the veterans that you know who served in Afghanistan and other places, if you'd reach out, make certain that they are aware of the value they sacrifice and that they did what they were asked to do and in fact kept the terrorism from attacking our country for the last 20 years from a base in Afghanistan as it happened 20 years ago last Saturday. Sarah will highlight and the other speakers, but I would bring my perspective. I mean, I'm returning to Washington, D.C. today. I think at front and center will continue to be this conversation of all the things that get wrapped up in trying to conclude the Democrats' attempt to conclude a $3.5 trillion spending package. What the Agriculture Committee has asked of its chairperson, we all as Republicans have asked in our committees, is could we participate in that reconciliation process and have the Agriculture Committee, for example, have input into the provisions that are going to be reconciled to the budget. I think that will continue to be met with deaf ears, and so it is unlikely that in much of any way that Republicans, who often are the ones who represent agricultural and rural states, we will have little input in how the $3.5 trillion is spent. There is a lot of interest, and this was mentioned by Sarah earlier, that there is an increasing investment in agricultural research, potentially in the reconciliation bill, which many of us would consider valuable. In fact, Senator Durbin and I teamed up and we introduced the America Grows Act to increase USDA research by 5% every year for the next 10 years. We've worked a lot on NIH and other research entities. National Science Foundation has received a lot of attention. My view is that all of our research capacity in the United States, in order to be economically and in a national defense perspective, to be competitive with China and others, we need to up our game in research, and that's included. That includes agriculture, and again, we have a bipartisan effort by Senator Durbin and I to do that. As I traveled Kansas, probably the most significant conversation, I suppose two: one, the need for workers, and two, the concern about the tax changes that may come from paying for the $3.5 trillion bill, and most specifically, stepped-up basis capital gains and estate taxes. Like-kind exchanges are often a part of that conversation as well, depending upon the nature of the business or agribusiness that I'm talking to. And fortunately, the Democrats in the House have chosen not to include that provision in their pay-fors. I also have seen or read where the Democrats are now beginning to wonder whether their $3.5 trillion bill needs to be paid for. And so maybe there will be less emphasis on those pay-fors, but the end result, if it's not paid for, is increasing inflation, which is another kind of tax on all of us. And so, in my view, spending needs to be paid for, and Republicans and Democrats were slow. Let me say it differently. Democrats and Republicans were slow in turning the spigot off on spending in regard to COVID. And the consequence is inflation, which the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board has tried to convince me is a temporary thing due only to supply chain problems. But you can't spend the trillions of dollars that we're spending and not expect there to be increasing costs resulting in inflation. And so that has a consequence. And Kansans are beginning, and it's returning to the days in which the budget, the deficit, deficit spending, inflation is now a significant topic of conversation from my constituents. We've working our way. I'm an ag appropriator, have chaired the Agricultural Appropriations Subcommittee. We've done our work, and it's passed the full committee, the full Appropriations Committee in the Senate. We're trying to tee up 12 appropriation bills. We've got three of them teed up to work our way. The goal is, of course, to have 12 appropriation bills march their way across the Senate floor, be passed by the House, and signed by the President by September the 30th. That will not happen. And we will have a continuing resolution that takes us sometime into December, would be my guess. And that continuing resolution is being drafted by my and other staff on the Appropriations Committee to accomplish no shutdown of government, but it's tied up with lots of other things, including reconciliation and debt ceiling increases. But I wanted to highlight in that appropriation bill, again, $7 billion to extend the WIP program for 21 and 22. Disaster, while a little bit less in Kansas than it was in the past, is an issue across the country, and now with the hurricanes and floods, fires, we've had a lot of challenges in agriculture, and so Congress and our appropriation bill has responded in regard to disaster assistance. It might be a surprise to think about that the Farm Bill expires in 2023, which now no longer seems a long time away, but the Senate and House Agriculture Committee will be back at work beginning the process of what a new Farm Bill would look like. And I would highlight, again, markets. One of the things I'm having conversations with Kansans about is tariffs. I would mention one that stands out to me. We worked hard to keep the past administration from imposing tariffs on phosphates from coming from Morocco because of the consequence to fertilizer prices. Those tariffs are in place. This administration seems to be intending to extend them. And we're seeing significant increases in the cost of fertilizer. And that is when farmers talk to me, they want to make sure I've not forgotten about input costs and the differences today. And with reconciliation and all the challenges that the Democrats' energy policies are going to provide to the production of domestic energy and to our least base fuels at the moment, fossil fuels, we will see increasing costs in the price of fuel, which means increasing costs in the price of fertilizer as well. this administration needs to hold China accountable for their phase one trade agreement and the agricultural imports that are expected to come from that. China is behind in its commitment to do so, but we earn a living in Kansas and in this country in agriculture based upon what we sell around the globe, and those markets remain the driving force for what price we receive for our commodities. I chair the Senate Hunger Caucus, and most of my colleagues are interested in food stamp programs, domestic kind of programs. I'm not uninterested in those things. In fact, many of them are necessities for keeping people from going to bed hungry in our country, but we continue to work, and I would highlight Afghanistan as a famine disaster in the making, and we're working to do a number of things in trying to get the UN food programs and our US food programs to be able to respond. And we're always interested in those parts of, we're interested in all parts of the nutrition and prevention of starvation programs, hunger efforts. But we always want to make sure the part of the programs, Food for Peace, that actually takes U.S. grains and commodities. I've carried with me for 2 years and showed the President, the Secretary of Agriculture, the U.S. Trade Ambassador, grain piled high in Kensington, Kansas, as high as the grain elevator. There's no place to store it, and a reminder that we still have a hungry world, and we ought to be looking for ways in which we take the opportunity to feed people who could very much utilize the abundance of our production. I also would indicate that while I mentioned phosphate tariffs, steel tariffs are a topic. Our agricultural manufacturers in Kansas, access to raw materials, but the cost of raw materials are keeping production levels as well as a lack of a growing workforce are indicating to how difficult it's going to be for the cost to remain competitive as we try to manufacture in Kansas and provide those that equipment for our actual farmers and ranchers. Last week I was at the Wheat Innovation Center in Manhattan, Kansas, and saw the latest in wheat research, and then toured the feed grain sciences program at Kansas State University and the Hal Ross Flour Mill. And good things happening with lots of students who are still interested in agriculture. And I again appreciate Dr. Featherson and K-State's efforts to find the workforce that this industry desperately needs. I'd conclude by just saying that the last time I was here 2 years ago, we were bragging about the capabilities that we saw in Kansas City to bring the federal workforce, in this case USDA employees, to Kansas City. And I appreciate this Secretary of Agriculture, who you're going to hear from shortly, his commitment to continue that program that was started by Secretary Perdue. And we continue the efforts to fulfill the jobs that were created in Kansas at NIFA and ERS. And what I think the answer is, because sometimes I read articles that talk about all the vacancies, but the vacancies are existent both in DC and in Kansas City. And we still need more people who are interested in the research and technical aspects of agriculture, and I always saw this as an opportunity for us to allow kids who grew up on a farm in the Midwest to find jobs in agriculture, even though they may not have a job on their family's farm or their neighbor's farm, and keep our kids in agriculture. And so I hope that Kansas City Business Council will continue to promote the opportunities for employment with USDA right here in our home city. I would segue from that point to highlight once again for you what I think is a major development in the agribusiness world that I hope that we do more to capitalize on than what we've done to date. It's not intended as a criticism, we're doing things, but in my view, the potential is significantly more, and that's NBAF, the National Agrobioscience Facility being built in Manhattan. And I was the author of the legislation that created the Animal Science Corridor from in this audience, I'll actually mention the University in Missouri, because I usually say some university in Columbia. But in this audience, I'll say from Manhattan and K-State to Columbia and the University of Missouri, an animal science corridor. And we are the place in which the significant number of agribusinesses are located here, animal science in particular. But with the arrival of NBAF, and the construction date is March of 2022, which is not that far away, is construction completion. And in May of that year is the certification expectation for NBAF to go to work. And as I assume that everybody in this room would know, that's the goal of NBAF is to protect the U.S. livestock sector from foreign animal diseases, including zoonotic, and we'll have the BSL-4 laboratory as we replace Plum Island off the city of New York and put that effort here in the heartland. We've appropriated in the ag appropriation bill that I mentioned earlier, $63.4 million. I had the problem that you had, Sarah. We don't say those words. So $1 million, which funds NBAF at its necessary requested budget levels for full completion. And we have added money to the appropriation bill for training of a workforce to make sure that folks are ready and prepared to go to work at NBAF. And the estimated impact, $3.5 billion economic impact to this region in its first 20 years. About 1,000 construction jobs have been ongoing in Manhattan, and there's expected to be 350 to 400 highly technical scientific PhD positions in Manhattan. And I don't highlight this just for the sake of Manhattan. This is the opportunity for all of us to make certain that we do our part to bring the businesses, develop the scientific and agricultural laboratories necessary for NBAF's well-being. While NBAF is a huge economic opportunity, I mean, I want to say it differently. Why it and of itself is important, I think the real value of economically is what can grow up around it. And this community, Kansas City, is poised for it just to be in a perfect place with Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska all here, providing us with a lot of assets, and NBAF adding, being kind of icing on the cake. And so any way that I can help Kansas City, any way I can help any community attract, in fact, I meet with a handful of businesses over the last year and a half who are interested in coming to this region just because of NBAF's arrival, want to know what NBAF is going to mean and whether it's going to be completed, and we are there to reassure those businesses that we're on our way. So it is now 9:17. You got your way, Bob. I'm delighted to be with you. The first time I ever spoke to a civic club after I was elected to Congress was the Concordia, Kansas Rotary Club, and I was invited to come speak. I stood outside the restaurant, and the club president met me. He poked me in the chest and said, "Now, Congressman, you need to know our meeting concludes precisely at 1 o'clock, and if you speak much longer than that, our club has the habit of walking out." And I thought, well, what a warm welcome for your new congressman and a fellow Rotarian. Only then, you know, there was a senator in Kansas who had a great knack for telling jokes and stories. It isn't me. But I remembered sitting there in Rotary Club that day about the little boy and his dad. Robert's probably told me this story. About the little boy and his dad who were in the church, it happened to be a Methodist church, and they were walking around. They got to the stained glass windows, and the boy asked his dad, "Now, Dad, what are the stars for? What are those stars for in the stained glass window?" The dad says, "Let me fill in one space." So I sat at the head table, only to discover that the club president was the local United Methodist minister. So the little boy asks his dad, "Dad, what are the stars for in those Methodist stained glass windows?" And the dad explains, "Son, that's for the people who died in the service." Little boy says, "That the 11 o'clock service or the 8:30 service?" And so I've been getting even with Reverend Ken Parker for a very long time. I've exceeded my Methodist minister's admonition by 4 minutes, but my primary purpose is to tell you that agriculture matters. It's a noble profession, feeding the world, clothing the world, providing energy to the world. And where we come from here in the Midwest, I work to do everything I can to make sure agriculture is successful, because it determines whether or not the communities that I represent have a future. And if agriculture is not successful, there is little hope for those communities that agriculture serves and lives in. Schools, restaurants, the cafe, the grain elevator, the farm implement dealership, all those things begin to disappear. But I also would tell you that in my view, we have a reason to keep rural America and agriculture alive and well, because it also develops a set of values, a matter of character, a thing called integrity, a work ethic, a belief in God and faith, things, those attributes that are hugely important to our country, something we desperately need today. And in the absence, I would ask you, I want to end on a positive note by making you feel good about where you come from and not so much worried about the country, but think how our country would be different today in the absence of something from Texas to North Dakota, this middle part of the country, and if it was only the East Coast and the West Coast, think what a different nation we would have been and what a different nation we will be in the future. Our ability to influence public policy and issues, to influence the culture of this country, still exists. It gets diminished sometimes as population and demographics change, but we matter for purposes of taking care of ourselves and our own families, but we matter for taking care of the future of this nation, and agriculture in rural America has to remain strong if we're going to have a country that we recognize as the United States of America. Thank you for allowing me to join you.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.